You're listening to a Day1.fm show.
Pick My Brain is the podcast where founders pitch me their startup and I try to give them some useful advice so they can connect better with potential co-founders, investors, media, and of course, customers. My name's Alan Jones and I was a founder myself for about 15 years, and after that an angel investor for another 15 years, so yeah, old. Some of my ventures have been successful and some failed disastrously, but I like to think I've learned a thing or two along the way, and maybe some of that can help you. So if you'd like to learn how to tweak your pitch, subscribe to the Pick My Brain show now, wherever you like to listen to podcasts.
Hi, it's Chris Titley here. As part of the FinTech Fun podcast series, we're joined by Jamie Twiss, CEO of ASX-listed BeforePay. Jamie, thanks so much for being... Actually, you're the first this year in 23, so there you go. Welcome to 2023, Jamie, and the FinTech Fun podcast.
Well, thank you, Chris. It's great to be here, and it's a real honor to be the first one in 2023. That's given me a lot of pressure to perform.
Oh, well, huge so, amount of pressure.
Which is both luck.
Yeah. I wish you the best with my tricky questions. But let's start on the tricky questions, Jamie. Can you tell everyone out there a little bit about BeforePay and the history and the origins of the business?
Yeah, so BeforePay is, we're a mission-driven organization, and the reason we exist is to give Australians access to safer and more affordable financial products. And our flagship product, the one that we launched first and that is still at the core of our business, is a small non-revolving cash advance. The idea is that when we talk to people who are in significant amounts of debt, who have gotten themselves into a bad situation, and you ask them, how did you get here? The answer is almost always, it started with something small. No one who is $10,000 or $20,000 or $30,000 in debt ever wanted to get into that kind of debt. What happened was invariably their car broke down or their pet got sick or it was back to school shopping. And so they borrowed a few hundred dollars and then they just couldn't get on top of it. And that number kept growing and they kept paying interest and they paid penalty fees. And suddenly, you know, 3 years, 5 years, 10 years later, they're looking at their financial lives have been ruined and they're thinking, how on earth did I get here? So our product is designed to prevent that from happening. And the way that we do that is when somebody needs a few hundred dollars, and in general, what most people want to do in those situations is they only want to borrow a few hundred dollars and get through the immediate need and then pay it back quickly. So we have a product that caters to that. So our average loan size is about $400. Usually it's only out for a few weeks. And the idea is that we advance you that small sum of money, you get your car fixed or you do what you need to do. And then when you get paid, maybe it's the next paycheck or maybe it's the next two or three, so we spread it out a little bit, then you'll just pay us back plus a flat fee. There's no interest charge, there's no late fee, there's no tricks and traps. And so the idea is that you need to call it $400. We lend that to you, you pay us back, and then we both get on with our lives. And so it's designed not to let people run that risk of getting themselves into a difficult situation. So that's why the company exists. The company itself is about 3.5 years old. Our commercial launch was in August of 2020, so about 2.5 years that we've properly been in market. And over that time, we've grown to more than 800,000 registered users at any given point in time. As of December 31st, the most recent results we published, we had 203,000 active users. And we're currently writing somewhere between 30 and 40,000 loans a week, and that's what we do.
And Jamie, just going back to when the company originated, August 2020, a time when there was a prominent COVID, there was a lot of people in lockdown situations, a lot of focus on the personal balance sheet as people had a little bit of time and also potentially their jobs were a little bit rocky and they didn't really know the outcome, and over the last 2 years, we've seen a macro drop of 9 interest rate rises in a row, et cetera. I mean, how important is it for people to get on top of the budgeting, but also the macro trend of like the incidentals and things that happen out of the blue? Can you talk about that and how you're sort of positioning your business with that?
Yeah, it's a really great point, Chris. So my observation, having watched, you know, the journeys that our hundreds of thousands of users have taken over the last few years, is that, you know, all kind of three phases of your financial life are really important. The first one being, what's your job? How much do you earn? How reliable and predictable is that source of income? So what we've seen is when people get into difficult situations, it's usually not because they made $55,000 instead of $60,000, and that's about the average in our customer base in the 50s. It's because it's often because their hours got cut back suddenly, or they lost their job, or there's some sort of shock on the income side. So having a stable and reliable source of income, then obviously managing their expenses. Now, I think there's a misconception about how Australians, especially middle-income Australians, manage their finances. The majority of them are actually really on top of it. They are savvy with their money. They know where it goes. They don't waste it. But if you are, you know, a young family and you've got two kids and you've got one income and your income is in the 50s, that's just a tough situation. But the second thing is being on top of your expenses. And then to your point, the third one is it's just, you can't always avoid every financial shock, but those large one-off expenses, and I don't mean large in the sense of thousands of dollars. I mean, you know, your cat gets sick and you have a $700 vet bill, or it is a car problem or something like that.
Appendicitis.
Exactly. Being off work for 2 weeks. So being able to manage around those, you don't know what's going to happen, but being as prepared as you can be for the unexpected is incredibly important.
And Jamie, let's go a little bit into your role at BeforePay and your background and how that's sort of intertwined now to become the CEO of a public company.
Yeah, so I'll start by saying that I wasn't the founder of BeforePay. There were two co-founders named Tarek Ayoub and Dean Mao. And they were the ones who came up with the idea. They built the company, they got it up and running and built it up to a level of critical mass. And then they both found it was an appropriate time for them to take a step back and think about their next kind of new thing. They're very much early stage, you know, kind of idea and growth guys. And they're looking for somebody who could come in and take the mantle. And so that's where I came from. And I joined the company's CEO in May of 2021. In terms of my background, so I'm American originally. My accent might have given me away there. I started my career in management consulting. I worked with McKinsey for a number of years, first in New York and then in Sydney. And while I was there, I did mostly financial services work. So I eventually moved over to Commonwealth Bank. I worked in strategy there. And then they actually posted me back to the US to open up the asset management business over there, what's now First Sentier Investors. So I landed there as employee number one of the asset management business in the US and spent 6 years building that out to a pretty good scale. And by that time, the kids were 10 and 12, and it was time to come back here for them to go to high school. My wife's Australian, and we always knew we would come back here. When I came back, I switched to Westpac. I was the head of strategy there for a period of time, and then I was the chief data officer. And then, as so often happens, just serendipity, somebody I knew that BeforePay was looking for a CEO. I was certainly thinking about where is the center of gravity of excitement and innovation sitting in the financial services sector. I didn't feel it was still with the incumbent banks. You know, this was late 2020, early 2021. And so when the opportunity came along, it was an exciting one, and I grabbed it with both hands.
And Jamie, let's talk about the progress of the company since you've joined. You mentioned that there is a core flagship product. There may be some more products to come, but in terms of user growth and revenue growth, and obviously the question that most people will ask from a investment point of view is the bad debts and how you manage that.
Yeah. So on the growth side, the growth has always been very, very strong. So the year-on-year numbers, they all tend to be, you know, triple digits, and everything is going up sharply into to the right pretty much at all times. So, you know, depending on which period and which year you're looking at, but we've gone from essentially zero to, you know, those more than 200,000 active users in a little over 2 years. So I'd say we're very pleased with the growth. And then in terms of bad debts, so you're right, lending businesses live and die on their ability to get the money back. It's not hard to get take the money and put it out into the world, but you need to make sure you get it back. And this, I think, really is the secret sauce at BeforePay. So we are a very, very data and analytics-driven firm. The way that we do our risk assessments and our limit setting and our credit decisioning is when you join BeforePay as a customer, you sync up your bank account. We look at all of your transactions going back up to 2 years. And then I know everybody says they have machine learning. Everybody says they have artificial intelligence. We actually have machine learning and artificial intelligence. We have a team of data scientists. And we work through our pretty significant database at this point. And we've built a series of algorithms that calculate a risk score based on about 500 different attributes, everything from how stable is your income, to do you take cash out of the ATMs, to how many parking tickets do you get, and all sorts of things like that. And off the back of that, we calculate a risk score for you. And then that flows through to whether we're able to offer you an advance, and if so, how what size it is. And if you come back and use the product a second or third time, then we have your behavioral history. And so there's quite a lot of sophistication that goes into that process. And the good news is it actually works very well. So we just put out our second quarter results. Our bad debts net of recoveries in that quarter were 2.9%. In Q1, so Q2 you always has a seasonal uplift in bad debts because of the holiday season. Q1 is seasonally lower because of tax refunds. The net bad debts in Q1 were 1.6%. So, you know, in and around that kind of 2% net bad debt level, we have very sustainable unit economics. And while we, of course, continue to invest heavily in upgrading and improving our risk models and our limit setting processes, we're pretty comfortable that that we're in good shape in terms of how we manage that risk.
And when people talk about AI and the engine behind it, I would imagine that the more customers, the more pieces of data that you have over time, that bad debts or that algorithm probably should compress. Am I wrong or right on that?
You're absolutely correct. So algorithms there are really two things you need to make a great algorithm. One is good data scientists who know what they're doing, and that's something I spend an enormous amount of my time on, but the real experts sit on our analytics team. And the second thing is just a good volume of high quality, accessible data. And this is the world that I lived in my banking career, was very deep in data. And as the first one into the market, and we believe the market leader, we have, I think, significantly more data than most of our competitors and would-be competitors. I think it's, what I always say is, this is actually quite an easy category to enter, but it's a very hard category to scale, because anyone can set up an app and start handing out money, and you will find customers who will happily do that. But it's very hard without a critical mass of data, without a bit of track record at this point, to build a set of risk systems that will ensure your money comes back and you have attractive unit economics.
Jamie, before we touch on you personally, let's talk about the future of the business and what you've disclosed to the market in regards to some plans and the sort of the macro environment you're playing into.
Yeah, so I think I'll start with the point about the macro environment. I've always been surprised that the business seems much less sensitive to macro conditions in either direction than I would have expected. And over the last few years, we've always looked at, you know, the chops and changes, and we said, well, hang on, you know, JobKeeper is turning off. What's that going to mean? Mm-hmm. Oh, lockdowns are starting, lockdowns are finishing. And to a certain extent, it drives demand a little bit, but in terms of the loss rates, it hasn't seemed to be that material. So obviously, we pay an enormous amount of attention to economic conditions. We think about our positioning, our limits, the risk factors that we look at. But to date, that hasn't been something that's actually moved the needle in either direction as much as you might think. More broadly, in terms of the future of the business, so we went public about a year ago in January of 2022. We were one of the last, if not the last, fintech IPOs to get away before the market obviously changed very significantly over the course of last year. I think it's fairly clear that you know, the market is not looking to give more capital to cash burning fintechs anytime terribly soon. So our strategy is entirely about grinding away towards profitability in our current market with our current product. So we do have good unit economics, and again, these are all public numbers. But we have net transaction margin, depending on the quarter, between 1% and 2% of the amount advanced. That's well within the range that we need in order to get to overall profitability. So our focus is on continuing to maintain margins, continuing our current rate of growth, and holding our cost base flat. So if you look at FY22 over FY21, our most recent full years, Revenue grew over that period 252%, while operating expenses were down 20%. We are really getting that operational leverage out of the business. And what we need to do is keep doing that, keep holding costs flat, keep margins in a good space, and then keep growing until we cover our fixed cost base. Once we do that, there are lots of interesting growth angles for us, but
we don't want to crawl before you walk. Yeah.
Yeah, exactly. We don't want to be distracted with kind of, you know, dreaming about all the fun things that we can do down the road, all the additional, you know, geographies we could be in, the new products we could offer. Our priority right now is absolutely getting to profitability.
Absolutely. So, yeah, the amount of times I've heard operational leverage and capital efficiency in the last 6 months or so, it's certainly been a change of tune to the last couple of years in terms of funding, the funding environment. Jamie, you mentioned you were from America, and I can obviously pick that up on the accent. Can you talk about a hobby or something that you may miss? Do you go back to America? Do you see your family? Is there something that you keep a hold of in Australia from your American heritage?
Yeah. So, look, I do feel very American, and I love the country, and it's always nice to go back, and it's where I'm from, and it always will be. Australia very much feels like home to me. So I always want to go back and see my family. Obviously, COVID made that difficult. I have lots of friends there. My wife and I actually met in the US at business school. So, you know, we both have a lot of people that we're close to over there. Australia is very much home. And I think really for me, the point of no return was Vegemite, you know, about 2 years ago in lockdown. I just thought, you know, it's time.
And, it's time to make the move. And how did you go? Did you have lots of water next to you?
look, the first jar is the toughest, and then it gets easier over time. And yeah, now I'm one of those guys, you know, you see you kind of sticking your finger in the jar. So no, look, once you've done that, I think you're committed, pretty committed to the country.
I'd say the opposite watching Sesame Street growing up, they used to have that peanut butter and jelly. Is it peanut butter and jelly, which is the peanut butter and jam?
Yeah.
And I just think, I look at that and go, what? No way. That can't be a combo.
Oh, Chris, well, you know, this podcast is turning into an emotional roller coaster because to be honest, I do still love peanut butter and jelly. So now you've caused me to question a lot of my beliefs.
That's it.
Don't know if I'm coming or going.
No. But the Vegemite, you did well. Do you have it on toast now for breakfast, or do your kids have it on toast for breakfast?
The kids are not big Vegemite people, but yes, that's what I have for breakfast, toast, butter, and Vegemite.
And do you start the day with sort of the g'day, mate? Do you practice your language?
Oh, yeah. I
or the no worries. That's the one, the no worries.
Oh, yeah. I think no worries. I mean, you know, even people who don't live in Australia have adopted that. It's just such a handy catch-all. I don't really know what I want to say here, but it's, I want to be reassuring. So, yeah, I can definitely bust out a no worries. I can definitely bust out a g'day. I title a lot of emails g'day because, again, it's sort of meaningless and seems friendly. I'm definitely not going to lean into the accent. I think there are some boundaries. People should know their own limitations, and that's certainly mine.
No, even from Queensland, we get a bit of a slowish twang to our voices. And then when you just one final question, now that you're Australian, do you get out and do you surf? Do you do any quintessential Australian things? What do you do in your downtime?
Yeah. So I'm a big bushwalker. My son and I in particular are pretty big campers, and we'll get out there pretty frequently in the summer, you know, hit the Blue Mountains, and then in the winter you've got all sorts of options. That's probably my biggest kind of Australian thing to do.
And what a nice country to do it in. Jamie, thank you so much for this interview today. It delved into different areas that I haven't delved before, particularly Vegemite. Appreciate giving us a bit of an update on the business, the history of the business, and certainly some of the future plans, and really look forward to catching up.
Fantastic. Thank you, Chris. Thanks for your time.
Listen to the Unfunded podcast brought to you by the Day One Network and hosted by me, tech writer Joan Westenberg. We're sharing the no-holds-barred untold stories from entrepreneurs who have decided to build a business on their terms. I'll be interviewing successful founders and operators on the grit and ingenuity it takes to build and scale independent startups without the support of traditional venture capital funding. Subscribe to the Unfunded podcast now, wherever you get your podcasts.